WCQCQ and welcome to Ham Radio and More. I'm your host, Len Winkler, KB7LPW. Today's show, sponsored in part by Amateur Radio Trader Magazine, MFJ Enterprises, and Ken Nichols of Earnhardt Auto Mall. We're not going to take any phone calls today, so don't have to run to your receiver, as this is a interview with Martin Ju, the president and founder of MFJ Enterprises. Actually, I'm really happy about doing this show. They are celebrating, MFJ Enterprises celebrating their 25th anniversary, 25 years in business this month, October 1997. And in the amateur radio business, it's certainly a long time. I mean, it's a long time in any industry, but especially in amateur radio, when you consider all the companies, if you look back, that have come and have gone, like Hallicrafters and so many others. Especially in light of some of the companies that have recently gone out of business, MFJ is prospering and is growing by what I have seen, leaps and bounds. Certainly they have the largest catalog of any company. I mean, there's not even I don't think there's a close number two, let alone a number two, when you're talking about 48 full pages of products. And every time I go and thumb through the catalog, I am really amazed at the depth of what they have. And I see a new product that I never knew every time I open it up. And so it's really behooves you, if you do not have a catalog, to definitely give MFJ Enterprises a call. Of course, their phone number, 1-800-647-1800, which should be etched in everybody's mind by now. But today, I want to talk a little about the man behind MFJ Enterprises, what the MFJ really stands for, and how he got started in business. A lot of people are unaware this is a fully American company. They're fully integrated. It's an American success story. So I want to welcome a guest who's been on my show a couple of times, Mr. Martin Ju, K5FLU. And welcome to Ham Radio and More, Martin.
Oh, thank you, Len. It's nice to be back on again.
Well, it's a pleasure having you, and I really was looking forward to doing this interview. You've probably done a few because it is your 25th anniversary, and others are probably talking to you and want to get some information about it. But I wanted to do a little bit of an in-depth interview with you, certainly about the company also, but about you, the man himself. And if you can tell us a little about your start, your early childhood, and then what got you even interested initially into amateur radio itself, let alone opening up a business like MFJ Enterprises.
I started out as when I was just a little kid in Cub Scouts, and one of the little projects was a little foxhole radio that you built out of a dirty, rusty razor blade and with some wire wrapped around an oatmeal box. And with that, I was supposed to be able to pick up the radio station. I mean, I built one, but I couldn't ever get it to work.
Well, even more back than that, what prompted you to even want to do that? Did you always have a desire to explore the unexplored, so to speak?
Well, I think so. It's just a natural kid-type curiosity and science in general. It was just a little project and a little Cub Scout manual. This must be 7 or 8, 9 years old, something like that.
Oh, so you were a Cub Scout, and it was in a Cub Scout manual that gave you the basically some kind of instruction to do this.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And so that perked your interest, and you built it, but it didn't work.
Yeah, the first one didn't work, but I finally got a crystal radio to work, and I was just laying in bed one night listening to that crystal radio, and all of a sudden I heard W5EMC, Chuck Sutter. He's a radio TV repairman in a little town in the Delta region of Mississippi, near the Mississippi River, a town called Hollandale. But I heard him talking on over my crystal radio set on 75 meters, because the crystal radio is so broad, it'll pick up anything close by. And of course, back then, everything was on AM, so I could hear it pretty clearly. That's how I discovered ham radio.
Well, you know, it may be interesting for you to know that when I interviewed Senator Barry Goldwater, the same exact way he got interested into amateur radio, as he listened to a crystal radio, and he was amazed that he was able to hear, at that time, he said, a signal that was like 40 miles away, and he was like overpowered by that. And that piqued his interest, and of course he became a ham at the age of 13. How old were you when you actually became a ham radio operator?
Well, I actually got a license. I was 16 years old.
Okay.
I had played around and with it for a long time before I got around getting a ham radio license.
Now, you were born in Mississippi?
Yeah, I was born in Vicksburg, Mississippi. My family are Chinese, and in the Mississippi Delta region, starting from about Memphis, Tennessee, down to about Vicksburg, which is about a 200-mile region, and then from the Mississippi River east about 60 miles, that is the Mississippi Delta, which is a completely flat land. Used to be a lot of cotton growing, lots of farming, that kind of thing. But in that area, there was a settlement of about 3,000 Chinese that came over 100 years ago to work on the Transcontinental Railroad. So there's a pretty good set of settlement of Chinese there. That's where I grew up in that region.
Mm-hmm.
And I came over here to Starkville, Mississippi, which is on the east side of the state, to go to school at Mississippi State University, and this is where I ended up.
Okay, and I imagine, I've not been in that part of the country. The closest I got was Columbus, Mississippi.
Oh.
Now, you said that's not that far away.
That's only 20 miles away.
Really? Okay. Well, then it is, I have been there, and it is beautiful. There were a lot of what I would call very rural areas as far as woods and stuff, if I recall, where they took me to eat someplace outside of Columbus, and it seemed like we were going through almost jungle land as far as all the trees. Forest is what I guess that it would be, with ponds and stuff. Anyway, okay, and of course, I do know a little bit, and your family had a family grocery store.
Yeah, we had our country grocery store where we sold everything. Most of the business was on the weekend, and we would open at 8 in the morning, close at 9 at night, except on Saturdays. We would stay open until past midnight.
Really? People came shopping at that time of night, huh?
Yeah, well, they came from the country, and the farmers, and they did all their shopping on the weekends, and they had a good time on Saturday nights, and sold a lot of stuff. So we used to sell everything. This is a real country store. It had these horse collars and kerosene, coal oil lamps,
Now, people, I would take it, now, not that you're that old, but I do take it that people came some on horseback there?
Well, no. Come on. That's after horse.
Okay, but I just wondered in the rural areas if some still didn't have cars.
Well, now, some did still have horse-drawn wagons.
Okay.
They did use that, and they were still using mules and horses to pull plows. This was back in the 50s, mid-50s, late 50s, and that.
Well, still in the 50s, I mean, in the rural areas, I mean, there's some, it takes some while for them to, and they don't even want to have, so to speak, city life.
Yeah, well, even back then, there were still people who didn't have electric lights. They were using kerosene lamps, and using hand pump water pumps. That was still common back then.
Now, of course, though, being a grocery store, you didn't sell any radio equipment.
Well, no, didn't sell any radio equipment, but when I was in high school, I used to do a lot of radio repair for the local people around there.
And how did you physically learn how to repair these things? Was it just by tinkering, or did this gentleman, Chuck Suddeth, actually teach you how to do that, or?
Well, most of it, I just got some books and started reading. Just reading it and got some radio and started working on it and understood how they work. And then I did learn a lot from Chuck, W5VNC, and just by hanging around him.
Would you say today that if people would follow in your footsteps as far as reading a lot of books, then they themselves would be able to pick up? I know certainly it's a little more intricate today than to put together, just a crystal radio, but you think you need a special talent today? Or?
No, I think the best way to learn is just get a book and start reading. I think the way that I really learned was just to read all the magazines I could, cover to cover, magazines like Popular Electronics and Electronic Illustrated. Those were Radio Electronics. Those were radio magazines that were available back then. And study the project, study the circuits, build some things, tinker with it. You get a really good understanding by doing that. But reading, that's the way to learn.
Okay, now let's look at it back in the 50s when you did get your ham ticket. Were you familiar with the American Radio Relay League at that time? Did you know that they existed?
I was vaguely aware of them. I got my license in 1960, K-N5-FLU, same call now, K-5-FLU, got a novice ticket back then. I had a license manual that I studied, and I think there was a little booklet called How to Become an Amateur Radio Operator that had some projects and some ads in there, and I can't remember where I got them, but probably from a TV parts store in Greenville, Mississippi.
We're taxing your memory here.
Yeah, well, that's been a long time ago.
But I basically what I was trying to get to was to see if the ARRL had more penetration, if people who were growing up and actually had desire to become hams knew about the ARRL, if they were out there really pushing and getting you to know about them. But obviously they were not that strong at that point.
Well, now, there was a year's set of magazines that I had borrowed from someone, UST magazine, and that was after I had gotten a ham license and just studied them pretty closely.
Yeah.
But they had UST has always been a good magazine.
Okay. All right, so now you got your ham license. I was very interested to see some of the things that you did for the military and stuff. So as a high school student, I read that you won some science fair projects. And did you win that? For what kind of a device did you build?
Okay, this was when I was in the 10th grade. This was in 1960, the same year that I had gotten my ham license. Let's see, 2 years before that, the Sputnik satellite had just gone up by the Russians, and the U.S. had just gotten up some of their satellites, too. So satellites was pretty important in the news, and the project that I built was built on this piece of plywood with parts taken out of RO radios. There weren't any new parts on there. But what it was it was a device that would transmit let's see if I can remember. Wind direction, wind velocity, temperature, humidity, and light. And it would transmit it over AM radio, and then there was a receiver that would pick that up, and then it would decode it. Now, all this was built out of just junk. For example, in order to measure humidity, I put two metal probes up and put salt over it. And then salt would absorb moisture, and from that you could determine, you know, the relative amount of humidity there was. And what that would do, that would change resistance, and that would change a tone of an audio oscillator. And that audio oscillator would be transmitted over. And then I didn't have any money to buy a meter, so I took and built another audio oscillator, and I matched that tone by ear. And when that tone matched, there was a pointer that pointed and told you what that humidity was. And let's see, the wind direction was a pot that was mounted on top of a broomstick with a vane on it, so you could tell what the direction was. And the wind velocity was another pot mounted horizontally with an arm hanging down, so when wind blew on it, it would just change the direction of it. And let's see, the wind, let's see, the amount of light. There was a transistor. I popped the top can off of the transistor, and when you do that, that becomes light sensitive. So that, the amount of light would change the resistance, and I use that to change the frequency of that audio oscillator.
Now, and you figured all this out, because you didn't have formal training at that point to how to do any of this. You did this from, ingenuity and reading.
Yeah, just lots of reading and just playing around with it and just playing with it.
Just curious, how much power did that put out when you made it?
Well, it didn't put much out of it to demonstrate that. But see, let me mention one other thing.
Sure.
See, what it did was it would transmit a tone for a certain amount of time, and for one data, and then it would switch over and transmit another tone for a certain amount of time, and then it would just cycle through that, and then there would be a dead period, so you would know where it started over. And the way that I did that was I had a switch, and I cut out a star-shaped gear, and there was a motor that came from a Braille display from the store that had an arm that would swing around. The motor would turn, and then every time it turned around, it would switch it over to the next position.
I say that was pretty clever, especially for a person, you were, well, about 15, 16 years old, so I'd say that's pretty good.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Now, you didn't just win a science fair project with this. The military saw this, huh, and they thought it was pretty good?
Well, yeah, it was part of the science fair. They just got some awards on it. In fact, one of the award was a trip on a Navy destroyer out at sea for several days. Got to go on a destroyer, got to visit submarines, got to fly in a Navy plane. I mean, that was a big deal for me.
It would be a big deal for almost anybody, even today. I mean, to go on a, did you get a chance to go on a submarine, or?
Yeah, we got to visit a submarine that didn't submerge.
Oh, okay.
But we did stay out several days on the destroyer.
Boy, that must have been something for a young child, a young kid, a teenager. Did you take any pictures or anything like that?
I don't think I took any pictures. I don't know. Maybe we weren't allowed to or something.
Oh, that would be something that would be something to have for momentum, huh? A memento. Okay, well, from there, after coming up with this, you never patented that or anything, I don't suppose.
No, it wasn't.
With a broomstick. Okay, then you went to Mississippi State University. You became an electrical engineer.
Yeah. I knew even as a kid that I wanted to be an electrical engineer. I didn't really have any good idea of what an electrical engineer did. I just assumed it was the same kind of stuff that I had been playing with. And I had a pretty good understanding of some of the electronics. And when I got to Mississippi State, it was lots and lots of math. In fact, I felt like that I knew less coming out of Mississippi State than I did going into it.
And you didn't have a pocket calculator at that
That's
time.
That's right. Slide rule hanging down.
I remember the slide rule. I think I had to spend more time learning how to use the slide rule than doing the math. It was a pain. Before I forget, when you got your license, how easy was it for you to learn Morse code?
Well, Morse code was very difficult to learn. When I was trying to learn it, I didn't have, we didn't have cassette tapes back then.
Or computer program.
No computer program.
Or no Morse tutors, I don't suppose.
No Morse tutors. I didn't have a set of code records or anything. So I had a regenerative receiver, which was built from a night kit. When I was in, I don't know, 7th grade, 8th grade, something like that, our family, if you made straight A's, we could buy something. So I chose to buy a regenerative receiver kit that I put together. And I used that to learn the Morse code. And a regenerative receiver is real sensitive to hand capacitance. I mean, you could tune in a station. These were ship-to-shore Morse code stations. So you could listen to that Morse code, but you had to leave your hand on that tuning knob. Because if you moved your hand, the station would disappear. It would just drift out. So you had to leave your hand on there and copy with your other hand. So it was really hard to learn that Morse code, but I finally learned it well enough where I could pass the test. And once I was able to get on the air, I could get my speed up and get my conditional license, which was the predecessor of DEC. Back then, if you lived, I forgot, 200 miles or so away from the nearest FCC testing station, you could get someone to another ham to give you your license test. And that was called a conditional class. It was actually a general class license.
But it was not a multiple choice test at that time.
There was some multiple choice.
Oh, there was, okay.
There were some fill-in blanks, and you actually had to write some answers down. And the Morse code test was, if I remember, 1 minute, a solid copy.
Well, of course, that's the ARRL's proposal now for the new deal that they have. Not proposal, but I mean it's a suggestion. To go back to requiring receiving one minute complete without errors, and also you have to prove that you can send, where we have been assuming that if you can receive, you can send. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and so you, getting your speed to 20 words per minute, was that a challenge?
Well, I really got that just through operating. Mm-hmm. I didn't really make that a goal until much later, but once I did, it really wasn't that hard. Mostly it was just fine operating.
Just off the subject for a moment, but since we're not going to revisit Morse code again, I just figured I'd ask. You have a personal opinion on whether you'd like to see the code requirement retained or done away with as far as a requirement for HF voice privileges?
Well, I think Morse code should be retained. You know, Morse code really is just another mode. It's another language that you can have a lot of fun in. I mean, it's just not a stumbling block, but it's a skill that you can learn and really have a lot of fun in it. I mean, if you're like most people, every day you talk on the telephone, well, you don't really feel like going home and talking to someone again. But if you can learn Morse code good enough that you can use it as a language, it becomes a real diversion, and it really adds a lot to ham radio. I mean, it allows you to do something that most other people are not able to do, and gives you a diversion that you just don't have in doing anything else. I think Morse code is a real part of ham radio. I don't think we should completely eliminate Morse code, but I'm not opposed to reducing the requirement of it.
But you would like to see some requirement, some basic knowledge of Morse code kept as a requirement in order to get voice privileges on the HF bands?
Well, I think so.
Well, I think that's very interesting, because most of the people, and the reason I say that, of course, you know, if people know me, they would know that I'm, you know, for the opposite. I'm for doing away with the requirement. I don't have anything against people utilizing it, but I just don't think that mode is any more important than any other mode, and we shouldn't treat one more than the other. However, most of the opponents against my suggestion say that it's the manufacturers that are wanting to get rid of the code requirement because it will increase business. And here you are, as president of the largest United States company in the amateur business, and you think that some form of the code requirement should stay. So for those of you out there who think that it's only the commercial enterprises that want to get rid of the Morse code requirement, here's a gentleman who would reap money, benefit from probably doing away with the requirement, and yet he's for keeping it. So I think that's very important.
Well, I think when someone takes time and learns the Morse code, he appreciates what Morse code can do, but he really feels a real sense of accomplishment. And I think when he does that, he just feels like he's a real ham. I mean, not that no coders are not real hams, but I think that's a sense of accomplishment that people really appreciate. And you can have a lot of fun with Morse code, too. Morse code is just, it's part of the hobby. It's something that you can take some time and enjoy learning. It's not a stumbling block.
Okay, well, I don't want to turn this into a Morse code debate, because I could go on for an hour about this. So I appreciate your commenting on it, and quite a little bit surprised at your opinion, but actually happy about it. So that's good. Okay, you're listening to Ham Radio and More, and we're talking today to Martin Zhu, K5FLU, the president, founder of MFJ Enterprises. And MFJ Enterprises is celebrating 25 years in business as of October 1997. And I am correct that MFJ is the largest United States manufacturer of ham radio equipment or accessories. Would you say that?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, would you also say that MFJ spend more money advertising than anybody else in amateur radio?
Well, I would say by far.
Okay, I don't think there's a close second. Just putting your catalog inside of QST magazine is more than most, than I think probably the next 10 companies added together spend. But anyway, all right, let me do a little bit business here, and you can rest for a moment or two, and then we'll come back to speaking to Martin Zhu and find out how he started MFJ Enterprises, and a little more about some of the things that he developed and built. It's kind of interesting. He's got a good past, a lot of experience. Let's first talk about my friend Ken Nichols, WA7HXZ, who's the fleet director of Earnhardt Auto Mall. Now, Ken has been a sponsor of my show since April of 1991, and he is a good friend of mine at this point, probably because I bought so many vehicles from him. But not only have I bought a lot of vehicles from him, lots of listeners have, as well as lots of friends and relatives of mine. I know from personal experiences, people who have purchased cars and trucks and vans from Ken, and they're absolutely delighted. You know, auto salesmen are not what I would call on high on my list of enjoyment people. Usually they want to pound you into the ground to make you make the sale that minute. They want to, you know, boiler room tactics they want to use. How much will you pay for this? Blah, 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 blah. And it's just not a fun experience. But if you call Ken Nichols, who works for the largest Dodge dealer in the world, bar none, that is a fact. But they also sell more than Dodge. They sell more than Kia. They sell Ford. They sell Chevy. They sell so many different products as far as vehicles or brand names. It's stymieing. It's just unbelievable. If you give him a call, you just tell him the make and model and options that you want on your vehicle. He'll give you the list price and the discounted price that he'll sell it to you right there on the phone. And then your local dealer will have the vehicle. You'll get it to them. You just sign on the dotted line and drive your vehicle away. It's that simple. Do yourself a favor and enjoy purchasing your next car from Ken Nichols, WA7HXZ. His phone number, 1-800-497-8740, extension 580. Again, 1-800-497-8740. Extension 580. Ken Nichols, fleet prices direct to you. Let me tell you about Amateur Radio Trader Magazine. Well, it comes out twice a month. And if you're looking to sell a product, if you have something used that you want to sell, this is the magazine. I mean, Mr. Smith does a tremendous job in producing and publishing this magazine. It comes out, like I say, twice a month, and it's really loaded with a lot of information. People are unaware. People think it's just a buy-sell trade item, a magazine, but in reality, it has lots of good information. It talks about propagation reports. It gives you repeater information. It talks about different products. And it has lots of commercial ads in here, like MFJ Enterprises is in here. They're actually giving away stuff for a D-Expedition, Arts D-Expedition prize. So they're a sponsor there. And it's really a good magazine. You should get a subscription to it. Or if you want to sell a product, give them a call and run an ad. 1-800-77-HAM-AD. 1-800-774-2623. That's 1-800-774-2623, Amateur Radio Trader Magazine. Now, MFJ Enterprises. Well, 1-800-647-1800 should be a phone number that by now is on the tip of everybody's lips because I say it enough. They have a product that I've been utilizing in my home and in my shack for the last couple of weeks or so, and it's the MFJ 9406. And I guess what you would call it is a 6-meter sideband radio. Now, you know, the one thing that really hits you first, beyond everything else, is that it's, I think, ridiculously low priced. You can't go out and buy a 6-meter radio for $259.95, including a microphone or less, from anybody. And here you can buy one that puts out enough power to make it to wherever. And if the bands are open, it's amazing what you can do. I mean, it has a super hot receiver. It really does. It puts 10 watts out, okay? So you have no problem. Rad chew with your local friends. I can tell you that I have done that. I have talked to people on 6-meter sideband locally here in the Phoenix area. It certainly has a volume control. The microphone works pretty darn good. It's so simple to operate. Let me tell you, you know, if I can operate it, anybody can operate it. I mean, all you have to do is pick up the microphone. It has what MFJ calls the constant current speech processor, which raises the 10 watts PEP to new heights, delivering even more of a punch than if, you know, that it's like if you were putting out more than 10 watts. This radio, if you're looking to get on to 6 meters, and if you're a no-code tech, it's the only band that you can utilize that will really give you DX capabilities. When the band's open, who knows where you can talk. Our professor, AA7A, Ned Stearns, who's on this show frequently, will tell you that on 6 meters, he has more than 100 countries confirmed. So you can do that too, and there's no reason you can't do it with the MFJ9406. So if you're looking to get onto 6 meters, this is the product. You can certainly call MFJ Direct at 1-800-647-1800, or you can contact your local dealer. They'll also be able to give you the MFJ9406. Again, if you want more information or you want a free catalog, call MFJ at 1-800-647-1800. And remember, too, they have the MFJ No Matter What warranty. So your MFJ product comes with MFJ's famous No Matter What 1 year unconditional warranty. They'll repair or replace it no matter what for a full year. That's MFJ Enterprises. And today we're talking to the president and founder of MFJ Enterprises, Martin Ju, K5FLU. And basically we've got so far your high schooling, then you went to college, and you got your master's degree also at MSU? Oh, no, Georgia Tech. At Georgia Tech. And then you went, back home and helped out again in the grocery store business.
Yeah, I ran the grocery store for my brother for 6 to 9 months, and that's where I learned about business, learned how to sell, learned how to take care of the customers, learned lots about promotion, but that was my graduate school for business.
Well, there's nothing better, I don't think, than hands-on experience. It teaches you everything. You know, you can read all the textbooks, but until you do it, you learn a whole lot more. Now, you then went to Champaign, Urbana, and of course, I know there's a university there, but I don't think you were involved with the university. Were you there?
No, I went to work. This was during the time of the Vietnam War. I was working for the military division of Magnavox, designing electronics for the Vietnam War. Went there for a while and also went up to Fort Wayne, Indiana to work at Magnavox up there in some anti-submarine warfare stuff up there. And then I came back to Mississippi State University to work toward a PhD degree, and I taught out there for a while and also worked on the research project at the same time that I was starting MFJ.
Now, what possessed you to start MFJ? I mean, sure, you were making a few dollars, I would imagine, at Magnavox. If you were in the military division, you're probably doing fairly well. You just loved amateur radio so much that you decided you could be a help, or did you hope to make millions of dollars? What was your purpose for starting it initially?
Well, growing up in a grocery store, I thought that everybody was in business for themselves. I mean, I didn't understand the idea of people working in a job. So I was always going to be in some kind of a business, and it really, didn't matter what it was. So I thought I would just try out ham radio, since that was my hobby for so long, and just built the product and started selling it through the mail.
What was your first product?
The first product was an active audio filter for Morse code.
No wonder you like Morse. No, go ahead. All right. And it was an active filter. And what did it do?
Well, it it had a very narrow bandwidth for back then. Its bandwidth was 80 hertz wide. It made up of low-key stages, so it did not ring. Now, this is back during the days when op-amps had first come on the market and active filters were just beginning to be known. So we had built one of the very first active filters that was sold in the ham radio market, and it was had very sharp skirts and narrow bandwidth so that you could actually pull out a single CW station among lots and lots of them on the band, and it just sold for $9.95 of the kit.
As a kit, yeah. You didn't build it for them.
Well, $12.95 of the kit.
How much can you buy it for today?
Not that much more.
Uh-huh.
I mean, about the same, I guess.
About the same?
No, I doubled the price, I would say.
Okay. Well, money, of course, has more than doubled, so you'd be getting a bargain. You know, that's something, I don't want to get off the beaten path, but, you know, some people claim that prices today, you know, they say, oh, it's so expensive to buy ham gear, that's why I'm not going to get into the ham radio hobby. I find that so untrue. When you can go to the store and buy a dual-band handy talkie for $225, that's unheard of. I mean, you know, a few years back, the cheapest dual band was $600 for a handy talkie.
Oh yeah, there's lots and lots more value now than it used to be.
Yeah, so I think people are a little cockeyed when they say that that prices today are too high. If anything, they're giving it away. I mean, when can you get an ICOM? Well, you know, I don't want to give anybody any special plugs, but a radio that has all the HF bands, 6 meters and 2 meters, all in one box for $1,100. You know, and it's so small. So okay, so you started out mail ordering, and you started out with this product, and from there, what did you go to?
Well, I was still teaching then, so I could make enough money to eat.
Well, if you sold thousands of these, it wasn't too bad.
Yeah. Well, I used to take bags of parts to class and ask if there were any students that would like to put these together and be paid per piece. So, but in the beginning, I had always done everything. But I spent one summer with a group of my students, and we developed several different products and started running some full-page ads in, I think it was QST, and that's started selling more and more products. There were things like, QRP transmitter, a VFO, crystal calibrator, electronic gear, that kind of projects, and more filters.
And where was your first factory, or your, whatever you want to call it? Was that in your house, obviously?
Well, I started building those filters in my apartment. I was drilling the boards and just doing everything. But the first place that we actually rented was a hotel room in downtown Starkville. At that time, it was a rundown hotel. It's now has been converted to a luxury hotel here in Starkville.
Really?
But back then, it was pretty rundown. And there was a room that they couldn't rent to anyone else, and the bathroom wouldn't work and all that. So we were able to rent that room for $16 a month.
Oh, man. Okay. You only had to sell two of these to pay the rent. Okay. And from there, you slowly grew, I would take it.
Yeah, it took us a while to get to a point where I could finally leave the university and be able to make a living on it.
When was that?
Let's see. I think that was about 1977 or so.
Okay.
So
you're basically about 5 years into the operation of MFJ when you started to take off on a decent scale.
Yeah, when I could finally make enough money to be able to just live on that. We had probably six or seven, eight people at that point.
Mm-hmm. How many do you have today?
We have over 200 now.
Wow, 200 employees. Now, could you go back to any one product that sort of really put you in mainstream?
Well, I would say that after the those audio filters, the next product that really sold well were the line of antenna tuners. We first built a random wire tuner, and we still sell a version of that, and then a T-network tuner, and then the one that really started selling was a T-network tuner with a built-in SWR watt meter and an antenna switch that sold for $79.95, complete tuner, that we worked for the low for the just barefoot rigs, and that really started selling a lot of them then.
Now you made a comment a few minutes back that when you were teaching, you know, and you guys got together one summer and you came up with some ideas for products, you made some of them. Isn't that almost what your business tends to even be to this day, where the consumers are saying, hey, MFJ, please, we need a blankety blankety blank, and you guys are filling that need?
Well, yeah, you know, engineers tend to do things backwards. They tend to have a product that they like, that they want to build, and then they try to go out and sell it to someone. Well, that's completely backwards. I mean, why would somebody want to buy something you want to sell to them that you want to build? What you need to do is find out what they want, and then just give it to them. And that's what we do.
And you also pride yourself, I guess this would be an unwritten, or who knows, you might have it written down, but a goal or a part of a doctrine of MFJ is you tend to always be, at least from what I have seen, even if somebody else, another company, has a similar product that does something similar, you tend to always be cheaper.
Well, we want to give as much value as we can. We want to do that, and we also want to make sure we take care of our customers.
Mm-hmm.
Because our customers, that's who we serve.
Now, when it comes to being able to produce this or to sell at a lower price, part of that is because now, with your 200-plus employees, you're actually making the cases and everything. I mean, you're fully integrated.
Yeah, well, you're right. That's one of the ways that we try to keep our costs low, but still deliver a real good quality product. We try to do as much as we can in-house. We have computer-controlled punch presses, metalworking equipment, where we can take in a sheet of metal, a sheet of aluminum that's the size of a door, put it into a punch press, and it'll punch out complete cabinets. And then we have machines that will bend it, and we can clean the metal, we can paint the metal, we can chip screen it. We have a print shop that we use to print our instruction manuals, the catalogs, even some of the books. We do the electronic design here. We lay out the PC boards. We build a prototype. We even set up and take the pictures of our products. We lay out the front panels. We write the instruction manuals. We do as much as we can in-house to try to keep the cost down as low as we can. And we have gone to, in the last few years, we have gone to a completely different type of manufacturing that has really improved our quality tremendously. And it has improved our delivery time, and we're using quality to reduce our cost. If we can build a product right the first time, then we don't have to do rework and repair and the customers are more happy, and that reduces the cost. And when we get a product working perfectly, then we would improve the production again. It's a continuous improvement process. Once we get it to working as good as we can, then we'll look for things like when you pack the product, make sure all the knobs are pointing straight up, make sure there are no fingerprints on the meter faces, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just a continuous improvement process. So by working toward quality, we actually produce a product that costs less.
Well, and of course, this is the old cliche, and I guess the generalization, but hams tend to be cheap creatures. So the fact that you guys produce a good product at a low price is right in the ballpark with most hams.
Well, you know, we think our ham customers is our most important assets, and we do everything that we can to make sure our customers are satisfied. We have a whole group of customer service people that just work with the hams whenever they have any kind of a problem.
And that's true. I mean, I've heard people who have had, you know, every once in a while, you know, when you sell the volume that you do, you're going to have a product that just doesn't work properly out of the box. And they have mentioned that if that does in fact happen, they either get a replacement or it's fixed and back in really fast turnaround time compared to some of the companies, let's just say on the West Coast, that when something is broke, it could be 3 weeks before they see it again or more. So, okay. Let me just quickly tell people about the MFJ-418. Now, I know we were joking a little while earlier about the about learning Morse code, and when Mr. Jew was younger and he was learning it, he didn't quite have a code tutor to be able to learn it, and he probably wishes he did. Of course, back then, they didn't have CPUs like they do today to be able to do all these things. But this is a rather new product, the MFJ-418, and it is a pocket-sized Morse code tutor, which will allow you to learn Morse code fast anywhere. The LCD display lets you check your copy instantly. It has a no-code beginner's course, someone who doesn't know anything and wants to learn it at 5 words per minute just to pass their Tech Plus can do that. And it will even take you way, way beyond the extra class license, so you can go, 50, 60 words per minute if you want to. It has customized practice, plain English QSOs, word recognition mode, and interactive mode. Now, let me tell you what I think is the real benefit of the MFJ-418, and that's opposed to tapes. And I believe MFJ also has tapes if you want to learn that way, but I'll tell you, the problem that I find with tapes, or that I have found when I was studying years back, is that you start memorizing what's on the tape. And, you know, you know that an E is coming next, or a G, because you have actually memorized it. It's not necessarily true that you are learning the code, you're memorizing what's on that tape. With this code tutor, you don't have that problem, because you can make it so it's totally random. And with totally random code sessions, there's no way you're going to memorize it, and you really can learn it well. So why don't you think about getting the new MFJ-418, and it's only $79.95 or less, depending on where you're purchasing it. And if you're wanting more information or you want to buy the product, certainly give MFJ a call, 1-800-647-1800, 1-800-647-1800. Remember, they do have a worldwide website, and you can access that on the web, www.mfjenterprises.com. As easy as that, www.mfjenterprises.com, or 1-800-647-1800. And remember, if you don't have their catalog, give them a call and tell them to send you one, because it's worth reading, and it'll take you a long time to read their catalog, because every product has in-depth information, so you can find everything and anything you want to know about all their products. Okay, today, the time is really going fast. We've only got about another 6, 7, 8 minutes. We're talking to Martin Jew, the president and founder of MFJ Enterprises. K5FLU is his call sign. And we've basically brought you up to date on where MFJ is today. I'm curious, you know, if you have any products that are on the horizon that you would want to leak out as to what we can look for coming from MFJ? Or if not, that's okay. If there isn't something, you know, I understand. But I thought I'd ask. No, okay. that's all right.
That'll start to show up.
No problem. All right, let me ask you a different question. And let me say that you are, you know, the largest company out there. You're advertising the most, etc. What do you see in today's ham radio community of 700 and some thousand licensed hams that is different, or the new breed of ham that is different from what you saw, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago? I think there's a lot of differences, a lot of changes. Do you see anything that would be major, and what we can maybe do to attract more people to amateur radio than we are getting?
Well, of course, I think the key to that is just communicating with as many people as we can and let them know what the hobby is. Now, the ham today is pretty different from the hams of yesteryear. Many of the hams of yesteryear were very technically oriented, there's many of them were more interested in the electronic part of it. I think nowadays the hams are I'm not really sure what word to use, but
more using it as a communications hobby?
Yeah, they're more interested in the communication side, yeah. They're more social group, and they just like to interact with people more than the technical side of it.
Is that good or bad, do you think?
Well, I think it's just the way the world is. I don't think it's good or bad. It's just the way things are. You know, back then, ham radio in general was high tech. Now it's not so high tech anymore. I think ham radio is a hobby, just like fishing is a hobby. You can go to any store, go to Kroger, any grocery store, and buy all the fish that you want to buy, you know, just cook it and you can eat it. So, but fishing is not about catching fish to eat or cook. Fishing is about fishing. It's a hobby. And just like ham radio, it's not about just talking to someone. I mean, if you wanted to talk to someone, you could do that 100 years ago by picking up a telephone. Ham radio is a sport just like fishing, and I think it will always be around. It's just a hobby that people just enjoy, and so many different aspects of ham radio that I think it'll just be with us for a long, long time.
Well, hopefully it will stay with us. You know, I have seen some the growth of amateur radio certainly have a big spike and grow very rapidly after the no-code tech license was approved, but recently it has slowed down, and the only class of license that has really shown an increase is the no-code tech. In actuality, The others have actually slowed down in growth. It's kind of scary in some respects, and I just am always looking for things that we as hams can do to continue to get more young people involved and, you know, get new people into amateur radio. Today, with all the stimuli from outside, with computers and TV and you name it, it's a little more competitive than it used to be to get people interested in amateur radio.
Well, you're right. It is, and it's a communications problem. It's about letting people know about it. That's with so many ways that we have to communicate, so much information that's out there for people to look at and listen to. It's just hard to get into people's minds.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we try to do on the Ham Radio and More show. Next week, it's funny, because next week Phil Anderson is going to be my guest. And Phil wrote a book called Crystal Set Projects, 15 Radio Projects You Can Build, and it's new. So we'll see about building some crystal sets anyway. Mr. Jew, K5FLU, I want to thank you very, very much for being my guest today on the Ham Radio and More show. I think we've certainly given a good rundown of you and your company, and we wish you and MFJ Enterprises many, 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 many more years.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed being on your show, Lynn.
Okay, thank you very much. And thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll see you again next week. And until then, this is Len Winkler, KB7LPW 73, WRT.